Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very exciting new mystery author. Actually, this is her second novel, but it's still new to me because I just read both of them. Her name is Linda Castillo, and her book is Pray for Silence. This is the second in the series. Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for being here. They told me before the interview how nice of a person you are.
Oh, really?
So,
with that,
whoever your publicist is, they did a good job because they said, "Oh, you'll love Linda.
Okay.
You have a good reputation at St. Martin's Minotaur."
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah. So you must be a very nice person, and you look very pleasant. I mean, when you look at you on the inside, that you just look like you're a fun person.
You know, I'm a Midwesterner, but you know, sometimes looks can be deceiving. But I think in this case, I hope it's not.
Well, I find it interesting that some authors, when they're thriller writers, actually, their pictures on the outside of the books, they have to look mean or menacing, like they're evil people themselves, in order to convey that essence of, maybe they think if they don't do that, you won't take the book seriously.
Well, you know, they tried to make me look mean, and, you know, I just couldn't pull it off.
So this is the most exciting mystery series I've read so far this year. The reason I say that is because the first book just totally captivated me. Sworn to Silence is just a fantastic book. In fact, I would not be surprised if it won an Edgar next year.
Well, you know, since it was an 2009 book, it was entered, and unfortunately it didn't. But thank you for saying
that. Oh, that's right. I was thinking that 2009 was...
Right.
That's right.
Came out in the hardcover.
So I should have won this year.
And the mass market paperback, of course. 2010, but thank you for saying that.
Well, I would have given it to Edgar, no, hands down. I mean, this is just, one of the reasons Sworn to Silence is so good is because there's such a sense of the scenes. As you're reading them, you actually feel like you're watching these things. It's like watching a movie.
Well, you know, I tend to be kind of a visual writer anyway. I love setting, and I love description, and usually I end up having to pull myself back from both of those things so I could focus more on what's really happening in the story and what's happening with the characters. But those are two elements that I really, really love. I love just a very vivid setting and a really strong sense of place when I write.
And, you know, she's such a strong woman, and yet she's not strong. She's very vulnerable and very prone to making mistakes. And, you know, she's not the detective in a lot of these novels where they're just perfect, and you wonder, do they ever make mistakes?
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. I think one of the things that I love the most about Kate Burkholder is that she is not perfect, and she makes mistakes, and there are moments in throughout, you know, the first and second book that she behaves badly, and you know, not you know, in a terrible way, but when she the way that she reacts to stress sometimes. But that's one of the things I really love about her, is that she's not perfect and she makes mistakes. But I think what redeems her the most is that she's good at what she does, and if she does break the rule, she does it for a good reason.
I'm curious as to what your publisher thought when you first handed in Sworn to Silence. I mean, it's such a powerful novel, and it's such a powerful book. They must have had a very strong reaction to it.
You know, they did have a strong reaction, and I think that has really helped propel the series along.
And it sold well, apparently, too. It apparently did very well.
It did. I mean, the first book hit the extended hardcover, New York Times hardcover release, and the second book actually moved up on the list. It hit number 27 on the extended list. Basically my editor, who was new to me at the time, he basically said the same thing that that you were saying, that there's a very strong sense of place, and that when he read the first scene in Sworn to Silence, that he was there, and he was experiencing that crime scene at the same time that the character was. And I really think that's what captured his attention, was just that very strong sense of place And, you know, not to mention that it's a little bit of an unusual setting because it's set in Amish country in Ohio.
Now, there really is Amish country in Ohio.
And in the course of my research, I found out that Ohio actually has a higher population of Amish than Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. It used to be that Lancaster County was, you know, highest population of Amish in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's Ohio. It's Holmes County, Ohio, which is where Millersburg is set, which is where my fictitious town of Painters Mill is set.
I can't say, after reading these two books, that, I mean, my heart says I'm not really a big fan of the Amish, the way they act. And yet, I realize that's the way they believe. They really believe that they should act that way, but, you know, they're not the most endearing group of people.
Well, I think one of the things, you know, the main thing about the Amish is they want to be separate from the rest of us, the people who are not Amish. And they are very, very religious. I just did a tour, and I was up in Columbus, Ohio, which is just actually east of Amish country. One of the gals up there had read Pray for Silence, and she said, you know, she has lived very close to Amish country, and one of the things that she said was that she loved about the book was, I didn't portray the Amish as being perfect. And the truth of the matter is, they're human just like us, and they make mistakes, and sometimes they behave badly. And I think that was another thing that sort of set this apart in terms of, you know, other Amish set books.
And one of the things you do well that you don't see too often in a book is you are able to set a scene up so vividly that when somebody's getting bad news, it's riveting to read. And that sounds a little weird, but when you first tell these characters that a loved one has died, I mean, we can feel the pain through the character. I mean, it's amazing how you make this scene so real.
Well, you know, we've all, you know, most of us, as we get a little bit older, we've all experienced, you know, sad and terrible things along those same lines. You know, but I think one of the other things is I was blessed with a very vivid imagination. And so, you know, you take your life experience or things that people you know have experienced, and then you take literary license with those things. And I think that's how that happens. That's kind of my process, how I come up with those things. But I think I know the scene you're talking about, and that's kind of how I did that.
Yeah, it's quite powerful, and you want, you know, you want to see it. You don't want to them have just tell the people that their child is dead, but you really want to see their reaction. You want to feel like you're watching this scene, and you, it's harrowing, and that's the way it's supposed to be, because it's a very harrowing experience. I mean, whoever wants to know what it feels like to lose a child, to have a child murdered.
That is exactly true, and I think that's one of the things that makes the book powerful, is that whether it's a positive emotion or a negative emotion like fear or dread or, you know, sadness, a writer has to make his or her audience feel something, and that's what I try to do.
I mean, and it's such a fast-paced publishing. I mean, everybody's writing all these books. I mean, there's so many books coming out, and are they spending enough time making the books seem real? You know, is the question.
Yeah, it's my philosophy that the more time a writer spends with the book, the better the book's going to be. And, you know, that's with the caveat that you can't, you know, keep rewriting the book over and over again. But I try to never send a book out before it's ready. I've just turned in the third book in the series, as a matter of fact, and I'm about 50 pages from finishing the fourth book in the series.
Oh my, well, you're way ahead of us.
I'm a little bit ahead of the game, but...
And now I feel this sense of withdrawal now that I can't read the third book.
Well, what I like to do is, you know, the first draft is never great. It's never great. I like to get the...
Why is that?
What happens to me as I write the book, I kind of just like, excuse this word, but I just kind of vomit the story onto the page, and I get it out there, and it's usually pretty ugly at that point. I like to take a little bit of time off, you know, watch movies, read, do whatever, go back to the book a couple of weeks later with a fresh eye, and then really start hammering out the prose, looking for all of those opportunities that I missed. That's one of the things that I missed during the first draft, are opportunities for, you know, depth, or, you know, opportunities to make the reader feel things like that.
And your covers are getting better and better. I think the second cover is better than the first one. I really like that sense of the feel of the area. I mean, you feel like you're really in the Amish country looking at this picture. The ominous clouds in the sky are really. I mean, you look at the covers in these books, and you instantly think, "Boy, that looks like it really could be really good."
It really does. Interestingly, the first cover was based on a photograph. In fact, it is a photograph by Bill Coleman, who is a pretty famous photographer who does, you know, I think he did a picture book of Amish country. I don't know if it was Ohio or Pennsylvania. But, David, I'm with you. The second book, the ominous, the darkness of the cover, I think it more closely captures the whole tone of the book. And, you know, the first one was a great cover, but I think it didn't capture the darkness and the sinister tone of the book. And the second one really, really does.
And now that I notice it, there's something behind the title. There's like a red shadow behind the... And I didn't notice this before. There's like there's a silence word, and then behind it, it's in red. It's kind of interesting how they did that.
I'm actually looking at a copy of the jacket on the hardcover, and they kind of played around with the typeset on the Pray for Silence part of the cover, and I think it really works. They kind of pulled in the red a little bit from the name down at the bottom, and you know, there's corn, and of course the slow moving vehicle sign on the Amish buggy, and I think the whole effect really works for the second book.
How are you going to be able to produce one book a year? They're getting each book. I would assume each book gets harder to write because it has to be, or does it? Maybe does it get easier?
Well, you know, I've written other books. I wrote Romantic Suspense for Berkeley, and I tend to be a pretty disciplined writer. And coming from that genre, one book a year is actually a pretty comfortable pace for me. But one of my personal rules of writing is, this is particularly true when a writer is writing a series, because, as you probably know, a series can go stale.
Absolutely.
I think that every book has to be better than the book before it. And I think no matter what an author is writing, they can do it. It's a matter of thinking through the plot, thinking outside the box. And so that's, you know, I don't know if I'll be able to do that, but that's always what I try to do.
And that's hard. That puts a lot of pressure on you.
It really does. And, you know, of course, when you set a series, especially in a small town, you know, how many crimes can sort of take place, you know, in this small town? And I think that's one of those areas where readers of, you know, crime fiction sort of have to suspend their disbelief. I can tell you that in the future books, that, you know, at least in one of the books, I'm going to kind of touch on Tomasetti's past a little bit and kind of shift the setting just a little bit to Cleveland, which is about an hour and a half north of Amish country. And so, you know, that's, you know, I always try to think outside the box and keep that same level of freshness and intensity with every book. I mean, that's my goal anyway.
Well, it's interesting with Tomasetti, because what he goes through with his job, and then you realize he's really drinking himself to death.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, that's basically what's happening, and then they send him to this town, and you know, now he has something to live for, because now he really likes Kate. He's really taken with Kate, and I can't imagine what that would be like to finally have something to live for after all this time. Do you want to kill yourself, literally, with the pain and the suffering that he's been through?
I mean, I couldn't imagine. Well, I guess I can since I created the situation. But, you know, what he went through was really just about the worst thing any human being could go through. You know, his family was, you know, killed, and he's left behind. And so he definitely went through some dark days, and there were times when he basically didn't want to be in this world anymore. And I think that...
But how hard is that to write when you haven't been through that yourself?
Well, you know, I do have, you know, I just have a really good imagination. And I, you know, I sort of profile my characters a little bit and kind of push the envelope a little bit with Tomasetti. I mean, he really does dwell in some very dark places. And, you know, that's just kind of how I worked him. But I think, you know, Kate, as terrible as the case was that they worked on together, his relationship with her is what saved him.
And I wonder with Kate, I mean, even if she, I wonder if she's even going to have her job soon. If her, some of these secrets that she's hiding come out fully, I can't imagine she'd still have her job.
That's a really good question. And I don't know if...
I mean, you have plans to resolve that in some way, I assume.
Well...
We can't really go into detail because we'll really ruin the plot of the first book, but...
I'm sworn to silence.
Yeah, exactly.
Well...
I mean, have you? But you've set that up, so now it could be that you would have to. She would have to lose her job. But what I guess what I'm asking is, do you know a way around that already?
You know, I do know a way around it, and all I can say about that is I do down the road some revisiting, and that's sort of where I have to leave it. Because I really don't want to give away too much.
No, absolutely not. But now everybody out there is saying, boy, I wish I could read that book now. And you should be out reading Torn to Silence so you can catch up. It's a remarkable book. I mean.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You deserved it. It's just a wonderfully written book.
And reader response has been really overwhelmingly good with both books. And, you know, I'm very happy and thankful for that.
Here's another question, though, and don't take offense to this, but how does a woman, as nice as you are, write so gory, there's a lot of gore in these books, but there's a fair amount of intensity and blood in these books. How do you do that?
Well, you know...
And why do you do it?
Ever since I was a kid, I've always liked the scary stuff. You know, I grew up in Ohio. I live in Texas now, but I grew up in Ohio, Western Ohio, which is a little ways away from, you know, Amish country. But we lived in a house that was 168 years old. It used to be Stagecoach Stop. It was part of the Underground Railroad for a little while. And there was a story going around that in my sister's bedroom, back when it was a Stagecoach Stop, some guy hung himself. And it's always been those dark, scary stories that really got my attention and got the creative juices flowing. And I've just always loved the scary stuff. I love intensity in a book, and I love it when authors push the envelope. And so that's what I try to do when I write. If those things don't happen in a book I'm reading, of course, depending on what kind of book it is. But, you know, I get kind of bored with it and put it aside. I really love the wild roller coaster ride kind of books.
Yeah, and I do too, and I don't want you to change anything in your books. I wonder how people react to it. I guess that's what I wonder, too.
Well, you know...
What do your fans say to you?
Most of them say kind of the same thing that you're saying, you know, what's a nice girl like writing all of this creepy stuff?
And you know you're going to get asked that sooner or later. I mean, it's not like it's not going to come out.
Well, and, you know, and I have gotten a couple of letters, negative letters, about the language. You know, there are people out there who just simply don't like language. And I just try to be true to my characters, and I kind of like that grittiness because from my experience, which is limited, as far as police procedure, that's how cops talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't see them speaking any other way. And, you know, of course there are, you know, some readers have a negative reaction to that, and I usually just, you know, when I respond, just say, hey, that's okay. Donate the book to your local library or Goodwill or, you know, something.
I would hate for them to miss such the great thrillers. I mean, they're terrific, terrific thrillers. I mean, I think of the thriller today, and there's, you know, you read a lot of mediocre ones. This is definitely a cut above.
Wow, that's really great to hear. Thank you.
I mean, it and, you know, when you can take a book like Sworn to Silence and you lay in bed and you read this book, and all of a sudden you get scared out of your wits because of the weather, and you're scared that somebody's going to get killed, something's going to happen. You almost hear things.
Yeah,
and
you're
wherever you
feeling.
It is, but it also means you're doing your job very well. Because I can read, you know, 10 thrillers, and maybe one of them makes me feel that way.
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's the kind of book that I love. Those are the kinds of movies that I love, and so that's what I love to write.
Right.
I mean,
you and Lisa Jackson. I don't know if you've read Lisa Jackson's book.
No, I have. Yes, actually, I have, and I'm a fan. I mean, Karen Slaughter. John Sanford.
Right.
Not that he's that scary. He's terrific.
People find him, say he's a little too much sometimes. I've never found him to be that way.
I think that the Lucas Davenport, those are the books that I like, the series, the
right.
Prey series.
Mm-hmm.
He has really been able to keep it going, in my opinion. I haven't read the latest one, Storm Prey is the latest one.
Oh, that's terrific.
It is on my list, for sure.
But here's the question, though. The Amish, do they read anything but the Bible? Are they allowed to read fiction and thrillers?
They most of their reading, there's another book that, in the course of my research, it's called The Martyr's Mirror, and I believe it's written in German, and it's about the persecution of the Anabaptists. And so that's the sort of reading that they do. I do know, I made contact with a woman who, she actually wrote another author friend of mine. She had read one of her romance novels, amazingly.
Uh-huh.
And my writer friend, you know, she said, hey, you know, do you want me to hook you guys up? And I was like, yeah, great, I would love to speak with her. And communication is a little hit or miss because she doesn't have a computer. She goes to somebody else's house. But it's, you know, I think that they probably... A lot of them do things that, you know, other people don't really realize or know about.
Now,
most of them don't.
Yeah, do you live in Ohio?
I grew up in Ohio. I actually live in Texas now.
Oh, you're in Texas.
Yeah.
You're a long way from home.
I am a long way from
home.
So
why did you pick Ohio over Pennsylvania? Why not set it in Pennsylvania?
Well, they always say, the experts always say to write what you know.
Okay.
And I grew up in Ohio. I grew up in farm country, and, you know, looking, you know, when I first heard that, you know, write what you know, I was like, well, that's got to be one of the most boring places on earth. And then I took a trip to, you know, Northeast Ohio with my sister and brother-in-law. I think it was probably in like 04, 05, something like that. And I was living in Dallas at the time. Population for Dallas County is over 2 million now.
Wow.
So, back in Ohio, in Amish country, we're standing in front of this old farmhouse, 200-year-old farmhouse where my brother-in-law grew up. I hear clip-clop of horse hooves, and I look over, and coming down the road is this Amish man in a buggy. And, you know, having lived in Dallas, you know, at the time for, you know, like 15 years, it was like going back in time. And that was the trip when I decided that, you know, that would be an excellent setting, particularly when you have the juxtaposition of the wholesome Amish setting with the evil of, you know, of a, you know, thriller type plot. That really got my imagination going.
Hmm. Why don't you tell, everybody hasn't read the book, but give a little bit of a plot outline of Pray for Silence without giving anything away so people...
Well, Pray for Silence is set in the fictitious town of Painters Mill, Ohio, and probably close to where Millersburg is, which is Holmes County. And there's a young police officer working the graveyard shift. Usually it's a very boring shift. There's not very much crime in this little town. And he's on a backcountry road taking a leak, and he hears a scream, a man's scream. And so he radios it in and goes, travels, you know, takes his cruiser up the long lane to this Amish farmhouse to check it out. And when he arrives at the farmhouse, he discovers that there's an entire Amish family that's been massacred. And that sets into motion the whole plot of the book, solving this crime. And early on, things aren't the way they look. And so there's, you know, a little bit of a twist in there early on, and then the investigating of the crime.
Good, nice, succinct way to put it without giving anything away. It's very hard. That's the worst part of my job, is the fact that I can't discuss these wonderful plot details that I'd love to talk about.
Maybe, you know, next year.
But it's hard because you want to tell people what really great some of the scenes are and some of the, but you can't say it. You got to be so careful what you say.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to discuss and not put out the spoilers. I mean, unless you have, you know, like a spoiler section or something like that.
Right. I assume all four books will have the word silence in them?
You know, I hope so. I really think that I love that whole theme, and it really ties in nicely with the Amish, and it ties in also nicely with Kate's backstory, if you think about it.
Right.
And there, it's just unlimited, the things and the combination of words you can use with that. So I would love to do that. I hope so.
You could have one called Killed in Silence.
Yeah, or, you know.
Isn't that a great title?
I just found out. I don't have a title on the third book yet, but in the UK I do, and it's going to be Deadly Silence.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, and I thought, I love that.
Yeah, that's good. That's real good.
Good one. Yeah.
You really have some talent. I mean, you really, and I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing you. I really feel strongly that you have major talent here, and that you definitely could go a long way with this.
Thank you for saying that. I love it. I'm very lucky because I love what I do, and so, you know, hopefully those two things will carry me along and keep me going. And
yeah, I don't know. Other than touring in bookstores, which I'm sure you're doing, I don't know how you get the word out. Word of mouth goes a long way. I mean, look what it did for The Help.
You know, I think it does. I have not read The Help, but I've heard fantastic things about that book.
And, you know, the amazing thing is nobody that I have talked to has said a bad word about it. Yeah. Not anybody.
Yeah, I'm out on Amazon a lot, and I mean, it's got just, you know, hundreds of five-star reviews out there. But, yeah, I think word of mouth is a really, really good way to get the word out about books. I mean, I kind of fiddle around a little bit with Facebook, and of course, I do have a fan list. I send out bookmarks every year.
And you sent me some. Months. Thank you for this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yes, I did. I'm like, what is Linda Castillo? It makes me feel like I know you.
Well, you know,
it's very interesting.
It turned out beautifully, and I just think that that's a really good connection that a writer can make with her readers. I love doing them anyway. They come in handy for all sorts of things. And I just love them. I give them to everybody I know.
Now, I'm sure there's a number of people out there who are curious what you're like in real life. And what do you do when you're not writing? I assume you have a family?
Well, actually, I'm no children. I'm married.
Okay.
My husband and I have been married since 1986.
Is he a reader?
He is. He reads my books, and he loves them. he commutes and actually listens to the audiobook of Sworn to Silence. But we have horses. I barrel race. We have two Appaloosa horses. We ride in the canyon. You know, we've got Paladuro Canyon up here. And we've got three dogs, which we love our dogs. And, you know, not related to any serial killers or anything like that.
What's the weather like in Texas right now, even as we speak?
We are in the Texas Panhandle. And,
oh.
usually it's very hot and dry this time of year, but being a La Nina year weather-wise, we've had some rain, which has been wonderful.
And we need some rain in the worst way. We had a tiny bit today, but it's now, it was 102 the other day.
Where are you, David?
Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, you guys have been hot.
We need you to send some of that rain our way.
Oh, I will happily do that.
But you were... I'm curious, is it a really nice place to write, Texas?
You know, it is. We live in the Texas Panhandle. We're at about 3,800 elevation. So our weather here is probably more comparable to Denver's weather as opposed to, say, Dallas. But we live outside of Amarillo.
Oh, okay.
And I drive into town. Believe it or not, Amarillo is a small town, but we have quite a large writer's population up here. I meet one of my writer friends just about every day at a coffee shop, and great little coffee shop, and I take my laptop, and it is a fantastic place to write.
And you must know Chelsea Kane. She's listed on the back of your book as one of your...
No, I am so dying of curiosity. I have never met her.
Oh, you haven't?
You know, we've corresponded online. And, of course, I'm a fan of her books.
Me too.
She is another author. I mean, she really brings a lot of intensity, and she pushes the envelope when she writes, and I devoured her books.
I mean, why didn't anybody think of writing a female Hannibal Lecter before?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I mean, what a great idea. I mean,
it really is. I mean, Gretchen Lowell, what a fantastic villain. And, you know, I hope she is able to sustain that series because I just devoured her.
Yeah, apparently there's going to be a fourth one in the series now, which was coming out in the wintertime.
I have heard inklings of it. I have not seen the title or anything like that.
I don't think it has a title yet.
Yeah, it may not, but I'm a big fan of hers. While we're on the subject, Cody McFadden is another one who...
Yes.
Have you interviewed him?
I have, and I love his stuff.
Yeah, he really brings the same thing to the...
His second book, and I'm forgetting the name of it now, was...
Shadow Man, I think.
No, that's the first one. The second one, and I can't remember, Face of Death, I think it's called.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it is the most intense book you'll ever read. I mean,
it really is
just fantastic. I mean, I remember closing it and thinking, wow, that's just too much to take in right now.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he really does it. Somebody else who really... been around for a while, who brings intensity, is Tammy Hoag.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she really writes when she's, you know, her prose, she just writes with beautiful prose. I love her stuff.
So you've already written book three. You're into book four.
I'm into book four, yes.
Do ideas come pretty quickly? Does the whole idea come pretty quickly? Or do you have to think about it for a while?
Well, I like to start with a situation and... You know, I tend to be I'm really more of a plot-driven writer, so I tend to start with a situation, and then I build around that situation. Sometimes it takes a while for everything to come together. Sometimes I write it wrong, I write it incorrectly, and I'll think of a better idea.
Right.
And then pretty much, you know, tear it apart and fix it and go about it. So it's a little bit of a messy process. But usually a situation, that's what I think of. And that's how I, you know, conceive the main story idea anyway.
So you have a murder really quickly in the book. It happens pretty in the first chapter.
Yes. I think that's pretty much the way it has worked out so far. I can't say they all do that.
Now, is your plan to have Tomasetti in every book?
Yes. I think...
Is that stretching it a little bit? I mean, is it a stretch to get him into the story each time?
Well, I think it is a little bit, and it may be one of those places where, you know, readers of crime fiction may have to suspend their disbelief a little bit, but there is also a little bit of a shift in the focus of the book in book four. And I think that accomplishes a couple of different things. One being that it gets Tomasetti into the story without you know, without stretching reality too much.
Uh-huh.
And it also takes the book away from Amish country a little bit. And, you know, that kind of stretches the credibility a little bit with so many major crimes happening in one small town. And so the fourth book, that's sort of my, how I fix that problem is, you know, Kate, you know, what does she do during her off time?
Right.
And so that I think will help with that, you know, Tom Setti issue.
Now, will there be things that happen to her coworkers that we don't even know about yet? I mean, things that in their background that we don't know yet? Are there things that have happened?
As far as the other...
The other characters, I'm speaking more of her fellow policemen and the lady that sits behind the desk, the receptionist.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. There are things that they do come into play in later books, definitely. Big part of the story, too.
So you already have some stuff planned?
Yes.
None of which you can tell us about, unfortunately.
Well, I can. I would love to.
I know you would. I'd love you to, too, because I'm dying to know myself.
Yeah, but they definitely come into play.
Your book's kind of, and as I'm sitting here, are kind of reminiscent of a little bit of Craig Johnson's series because of the small town aspect, the murders in the small town. I don't know if you're familiar with his at all.
No, I'm not. I wish I was, but I'm not.
Well, you need to go out and read Cold Dish by Craig Johnson.
Cold Dish, okay.
And it's set in Wyoming, so, and you're a Western girl. It's perfect for you. But the reason I say it reminds me of his is because when you made that comment about how do you have crime in such a small town, well, the author himself lives in a town of 23 people.
Oh. So,
and they're set in a place in Wyoming, and now I'm forgetting the name of the place, but
uh-huh.
And it's a small town also, so
okay.
There's a lot going on in that small little town. So he's got the same problems you have.
Right. Right,
how do you
kill off his whole population if he's not careful?
How do you make it seem? And to me, you know, when you can't just murder somebody, there has to be a strong motivation. There has to be a strong one. I mean, if it's not there, it'll ruin the book in my mind.
I so agree. And it can't just be a murder. It's almost where, you know, readers are pretty smart and they're pretty demanding. It's almost like you have to make it sort of a high concept thing. That's what I really like to do. It's not what it appears. You know, that's kind of, you know, the murder isn't what it appears from the beginning, that there's something else, even worse, hidden underneath all of the topical evidence. Those are the kinds of crimes that I really like to write about.
And when you think about it, I mean, you can't repeat yourself in any book either. In other words,
no.
If you tell a joke in book one, it can't be in book three.
You are so right.
Everything has to be original and new. When you think about that, that must be very, very difficult. I mean, how does Nora Roberts write 25 in-depth books and make them all original? How do you do that? What in the world? She must be a fountain of information.
She is amazing. I have met her, and I've talked to her, and I've heard her speak several times, and she is just a phenomenon. But about that's one of the reasons why I did not want the second book to be a serial killer book. It was tempting, but I thought in a way that would have been cheating, and I really needed to do something else, a different kind of crime. And same thing with the third book. The third book, my editor actually, you know, of the three books, the third book is his favorite. And
really?
One of the reasons that I love that book and he loves the book is because it's got one hell of a twist. And I wish I could, you know.
Well, you don't want to tell us because then we'll...
Now you've really
got me upset now because now I can't read it. And I won't be reading it probably till next year. And That makes it even worse, but definitely something to look forward to. What did you say the title was going to be again?
On the third book, I don't have my U.S. title yet, but in the U.K., they're calling it Deadly Silence.
Oh, it's called Deadly Silence in the U.K., but it may not be that in the United States.
It may not.
Didn't they like that title?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the United States people like that title?
You know, I really don't know, and it may be that they may get together again and go with the same title. But I think they weren't crazy about it because nobody really, you know, jumped on it when the UK came up with that title. I love it, and I think it really fits the book. And it is going to be, I can't wait to see what they come up with as far as cover and title on this third book. It's going to be, that's kind of an exciting moment for an author anyway.
You make writing seem easy. Just listening to you, it doesn't sound like you lay awake at night worrying about where you're going to go with the story. So do you have a tough time with that, or is it easy?
What I have a tough time with is making the book better. I want my prose to be better. I mean, for example, I'm reading John Hart right now. I don't know if you've read it.
Oh, I love John Hart, yes.
He won the Edgar.
Yes, twice.
His prose are unbelievably beautiful. I'm reading The Last Child right now.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's always room. What keeps me awake is I want to be better. I want my prose to be better.
Well, are you gonna know right away if it isn't better?
Oh, I will, and that's where the staying up, you know, the lying awake at night comes in.
It makes me think of the limbo bar when you're playing the limbo game and you keep raising it, and how much higher can you go before it's as good as it can get, and each time's got to be higher than the time before.
Yeah, that's true, and you know, that's just, you know, not every book can be a home run. I mean, I know that, and you know, anybody that writes and reads a lot knows that. But, you know, it's that you got to try. You really have to try to make the book better and better and better. And hopefully, you know, the more you write, the better you're going to get. And, you know, I hope that's true.
Are you happy writing? All the time you're writing, are you happy?
Well, you know, some days it's the words don't come easily. You know, some days I have a writer friend in Dallas, and I tell her, some days it's like pulling teeth without anesthesia, getting those words out.
And now, you have to know grammar and all that stuff too. That's another thing I wonder about when you write a book. You have to know your grammar.
You do. You really have to have a pretty good grasp. I mean, of course, I make mistakes, and my editor catches it, I do have a critique group that here in Amarillo we meet once a week and we read out loud. And, of course, they catch it.
And do you have Amish people that you call and get opinion, and you tell them, you know, do you bounce the stuff off to make sure that that's the way an Amish person would act?
Just the one. I have met that one one gal through my writer, another writer friend of mine.
So she's your go-to person each time.
She is. And, I mean, there are some, you know, wonderful books out there. John Hostetler wrote, it's called Amish Life, I believe, and it's almost like a textbook on the Amish, and it's really, really good and in-depth. And, of course, the Internet, there's a lot of great information out there on the Internet. You know, you just have to be able to weed through the incorrect stuff, but I'm getting to the point to where I can really tell now. I did have a little bit of a difficult time finding Pennsylvania Dutch words. That is an obscure language, and it's a little difficult to find words. But you know, I did.
I love that word, Rumspringa.
Yeah, Rumspringa. Yeah, that's a good word.
It's a wonderful one. In fact, there's a book out called Rumspringa that we have in the store that I've seen a number of times.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, 2020 recently followed four Amish teenagers on their Rumspringa. Very, very interesting special. There were three males and one female, and you know, they're 16, 17, 18 years old. And the female, when they were interviewing her, she's wearing her Amish dress, cap, sitting on the steps, smoking a cigarette. And, you know, that's the time when they get to experience the world without all the constraints of being Amish. That's basically when they decide whether or not they're going to become, you know, get baptized and join the church.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's fascinating.
It is. They're fascinating. I mean, what with Witness brought a lot of the attention to when Witness came out. That was a number of years ago. But you wonder, what would it be like to live with the Amish for, say, a year?
I think it would be really tough. I really do. I think it would be tough. They really thrive on hard work.
They're tough on each other. There's no slackers in the Amish community.
There's really not. I mean, there probably are, but, you know, they believe very much in hard work and being very close to the land. They're very, very family-oriented. This Amish woman that I interviewed her when I first met her, and I asked her, what is the best part about being Amish? And she said it was the sense of belonging. And, you know, when somebody gets into trouble, they're there for you. They rally around you. And I said, well, what's the worst part about being Amish? And she said, they gossip about you. If you make a mistake, they talk about you.
Oh, man.
And she said that's really tough. So I thought that was really interesting.
That is interesting. I didn't realize they did that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, everybody gossips, let's face it. I mean, it's very hard not to talk about somebody else. I mean, how do you do that?
Human nature.
It is. It really is human nature. And it's not always meant in a malicious way.
Right, I mean, exactly.
Sometimes it's just you need to talk about it. And
you don't.
It may come out wrong, but that's...
Yeah.
Well, there's a lots of possibilities with this series, and I can't wait to see what's going to happen next. I mean, literally, it's thrilling to me. We've run out of time, but it's just been such a wonderful time talking to you.
Oh, David, you are a great interviewer. Thank you.
Well, I listen. I listen to the person. I care about the writing, and I care that it's a good story, and I like reading your books, and it's exciting that you have a series that we can all be excited about and look forward to every year.
Well, that's wonderful to hear.
The new book, again, is out from St. Martin's Minotaur Books, which is part of St. Martin's. Pray for Silence. It's in all your bookstores now. You can also get Sworn to Silence, and you have to read Sworn to Silence first. You really should, anyway. You don't have to, but it's really good. And that's out in paperback, too, so you can get both of them anywhere you want, all over the United States, in any bookstore, and online, anywhere online, too. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much, Linda.
David, thank you.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.